House Committee on Judiciary coming to order. Today is Tuesday, April 19th. We have several bills. They're not ready to go today, so I'll read those off, and that's what you're here for. We'll let you out of here real early. We're going to carry over House Bill 2653, House Bill 2712, House Bill 2014, House Bill 3104, House Bill 3324, House Bill 2461, House Bill 2650, House Bill 2693, House Bill 3186, and House Bill 3594. In fact, 3594 will not be coming back. That's going to go to an interim study. And that's to create the offense of refusal to identify. No, we're not carrying it over. We'll move it to the interim.
We only have three bills here.
Right. Okay. And those are all carried over until tomorrow. There's a seating or an occupancy limit in the room with the people that are standing. If you you'll need to leave and go right downstairs below us in the Senate, right outside the Senate chambers. And they have a TV down there that'll be showing this hearing.
We got 21 left, and we got 2 days to do it.
We need one evening.
That's correct.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2183. Representative Krieger, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2183 would create the crime of making a false report of child abuse. However, I've been directed to the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 3 amendments would modify the current crime of initiating a false report. As stands under existing Oregon law, a person commits the crime of initiating a false report if the person knowingly initiates a false alarm or report which is transmitted to a fire department, law enforcement agency, or other organization that deals with emergencies involving danger to life or property. This would add or abuse. As amended the Dash 3 amendments, it would also elevate the severity of this crime from a Class C to a Class B misdemeanor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. This bill came about as a result of a complaint I'd received during the interim from a lady. I don't even know if she's here today, but basically what appears to be taking place and what I have found out since we started this, clear back, I believe, in June or July, was that it's becoming more and more of a common thing, especially in divorce cases and also in some dependency cases, to have one of the parties use this as a tactic where they knowingly, with intent, make a false report of child abuse. And I think the thing that you've heard probably some, well, this is going to have a quieting effect on people who are mandatory reporters. It has nothing to do with that. The word knowingly, they know the report that they are making is false. And I think you think about how that could affect families, how that could affect, and most of the time it's a man who's being accused of abuse, and that's most instances. It's very difficult, as we've heard, on these type of violations to defend yourself. So we've done this bill. Elizabeth here has helped get this thing straightened out. She understands, I think, the amendments better than I do, so I'll leave the rest of it with her.
Okay. Senator Cruz?
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. I sit right there in the morning, so Representative Krieger asked me to come and testify on this bill, and just a personal story, because this has been going on for a long time. Back in a previous life, when I was getting divorced, and we were fighting for custody, my ex-wife, who I was not on friendly terms at the time with, obviously, although that has changed over time, accused me of molesting my 3-year-old daughter. And it was clearly unfounded, and the reason I found out about it was because the deputy sheriff who was in on the interview was a friend of mine, and he told me about it. But what happened out of that was I had an allegation. And so as far as custody was concerned, at that point in time, I was dead in the water, absolutely dead in the water, because there's an allegation, an unfounded allegation. And it truly was unfounded. There was nothing behind it. But what we have is a situation where somebody can make an accusation, and the accusation stands even when it's unfounded. And I'm hoping that this will fix that so that somebody in my position can actually get some remedy. So that was my own personal story, and I just thought I'd put a face on this thing for the committee.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come with this.
You bet.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Cushwell with the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We testified in opposition to this bill when it was in the House Human Services Committee. The bill as originally drafted had several sets of issues with it. Representative Krieger asked me to help with the bill. I explained that we already had false reporting in both the disorderly conduct statute and in the statute that has been subsequently referenced here to deal with these things. It was brought up to me by Representative Hicks that the definitions for child abuse in the dependency code are different than the definitions of child abuse in the criminal code, and that's what Representative Krieger was trying to get to. So to that end, we did amend just in the language that you see in the -3s was the or child abuse as defined in, and it just gets to a different definition. It keeps it all the same. District attorneys still do have a few concerns about the concept of carving, about this having a chilling effect on people reporting abuse, being afraid, especially in domestic violence situations, being afraid that that the batterer could say, see, no one will believe you, but given the fact that it's already been existing law and that there have been cases brought under existing law, we didn't feel like this was that much of an expansion. So that was the grounding for the bill. If you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Nolan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I'm not sure which of you would be the appropriate respondent, but my reading of the -3 is that it not only adds abuse, and I don't see the word child unless that exists in the referenced statute, but it also changes all false reports from Class C to Class B misdemeanor.
I think it does add.
Can someone explain why?
Chair Barker, Representative Nolan, it was the request of Representative Barker to maintain a Class B a B classification.
You said, excuse it me. Was requested by Representative Krieger.
Yes.
You said Barker.
I beg your pardon.
Sounds better, Barker.
But yes, I just want to clarify that encompasses not just knowingly false reporting on child abuse, but knowingly all other false.
Chair Barker, Representative Nolan, that's correct.
Representative Hicks?
And actually, perhaps staff could clarify, but under the disorderly conduct statute, basically similar conduct is already classified as a B misdemeanor. This is going to ask you to reach back. But the disorderly conduct statute, I believe, says that initiating or circulating a false report, knowing it to be false to a police agency is a Class B misdemeanor. That's the current status of the law, which I think is comparable to the proposal here.
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, I know what you're referencing, disorderly conduct in the second degree, and I'm aware that there is a provision having to do with circulating a false report to cause alarm, but without it before me, I couldn't say absolutely if this encompasses the behavior.
Mr. Chair, it's interesting as we've been looking at the dependency issue with the dependency work group, and then here again on this bill. One of the things we're starting to see is that there is, in fact, a lot of DHS time and also police time tied up in investigating these reports to find out whether they are actually substantial, you know, and whether charges should be filed or not. So I think you'd probably, I asked DHS whether or not they had any records specifically as to how often they're getting reports, which they look into and do not find any substance. They're unfounded, like in the case of Senator Cruz. But they don't keep that record. But the fact that a accusation is made knowingly to be untrue can affect somebody's life for the rest of their life also.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. So for me, this all comes down to the chilling effect, if it's real or not. And Elizabeth, I think I heard you say you have some concern about it, but not much, because there have already been some cases brought. I didn't quite track your position. Could you say more about that?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, the district attorneys are concerned with specifying out any particular crime, which is why we were opposed to the bill originally as drafted, that it carved out child abuse specifically as a crime, and that would have a especially chilling effect, setting it aside on its own. I think the district attorneys and law enforcement, the police, and the sheriffs are very good at parsing out the truth in most of these cases. They're called out pretty clearly, although I do realize that I know there's a case right now in Marion County that's up on perjury charges now because it has been elevated. The person has continued to take it up and up, knowing it to be false. And so I think that there are existing remedies. However, per the co-chair's request, really trying to narrow the bill from the way it was originally drafted.
Follow up, please.
So I'm clear, you think the chilling effect is mitigated because it's not a standalone bill anymore, but because we're moving this into an existing false reporting statute? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Representative Garrett, that's what we believe.
Okay.
Council?
Thank you. And co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Hicks, I've looked up the statute that was previously referenced, and there are a couple of distinctions that I think are important. Disorderly conduct in the second degree occurs if, with intent to cause public inconvenience, and that word public is important, annoyance or alarm, or recklessly creating a risk thereof, the person, subsection F, initiates or circulates a report knowing it to be false concerning an alleged or impending fire, explosion, crime, catastrophe, or other emergency. Now, crime would cover some but not all of what is in the abuse definition, I believe. But more importantly there, in terms of distinguishing House Bill 2183-3, is the word public. If your intent is to create a private inconvenience, to harass a specific person, to make a former spouse, for example, to take Senator Cruz's example, it's more of a stretch to make disorderly conduct apply. I believe that there is case law, and Representative Hicks, perhaps you can back me up on this, that you actually cannot commit a disorderly conduct unless there is a public to alarm. It cannot occur if there is only one victim. You need a public. So I believe that this actually does not directly overlap with disorderly conduct in the second degree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and I would agree with that assessment. Also, to go to the reference statute 419B005, and Representative Nolan had asked about that. Within the definition of abuse, it does say to a child. So abuse means, and it has an enumerated list, any assault of a child, any mental injury to a child, etc. So I'm satisfied that it is adequately. And while I'm talking, I just want to add, I do hear about the chilling statute. There is a dilemma here, the chilling effect. But where I'm coming down on this is that we do have, as Senator Cruz pointed out, an actual identifiable victim of this conduct. This does cause people to be victimized by this kind of false report. And so we're weighing that against, I guess, a theoretical concern or an actual concern that somebody might not report. And so that's really where the limit is here. And so I do, however, think that this does result in actual victims, that this is appropriate for legislative action. Thank you.
Thank you. Great question. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe the question is to you. So which amendment are we looking at, two or three?
Co-chairs, Representative Tomei, we're looking at the -3 amendment.
Okay. So does that change the fine?
Co-chairs, Representative Tomei, yes, the maximum fine, I don't remember off the top of my head for a Class B, but it is a significant difference between a Class C and Class B misdemeanor in Oregon law, plus the term of incarceration also would vary.
So, follow-up, please?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So, one of the concerns that's been expressed to me is that the fine for making a false report is so much more than not mandatory reporters not reporting, that again, this would create that chilling effect. So does this amendment change that?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, no, it does not. This amendment has nothing to do with mandatory reporters, and you are correct. It's a lesser penalty for someone who's a mandatory reporter, knows about abuse, makes a report, and fails to make a report, is a lesser violation than making a false report would be.
So I guess getting back to the chilling effect, wouldn't that still have a chilling effect? I used to be a mandatory reporter.
You still are.
Thank you for reminding. And so if I'm in a sort of a gray area where it seems to me that an abuse has taken effect, but I'm also fearful that this person might say that I made a false accusation, that if I had to choose, that I wouldn't. But someone could, I think, make a choice. It's not worth it to me that I might be fined this $6,000 fine, and I would only be fined a few hundred dollars if I found that if there was an abuse and I didn't report it.
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, in your example, theoretically, I suppose it could happen. The key word here is that you have to knowingly make a false report. So you make a report knowing it's false. If you suspect something is happening and it turns out to be false, that is not a crime. So this only is a crime if you know it to be false and you advance it as such.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, panel.
Oh, just one comment. You know, this chilling thing's come up, and it just doesn't apply. Any of us that are mandatory reporters, or anyone even who isn't, and has reasonable grounds to believe, you see a bruise on a child and you think it might be, you can report that. And then they do the investigation to find out. What if you knew that bruise was not from an abuse, it was from wrestling, and you perpetrated it as being abuse, knowing that it was, because you're trying to get at somebody, and that's 90% of that's what it is.
Thank you very much, panel. Next we'll call Mark McKinney, Tonya Hunt, and Gretchen Bennett. Please. We tried to reopen the hearing the other day, but you guys already left the building, so sorry about the extra trip down. I'd ask that you please try to keep it short. We've got a lot of business today, so thank you. And whoever, just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Hi, everybody. Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gretchen Bennett, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. While I hear the distinction about the lack of applicability to the chilling effect, what's got me scared is all the confusion that can still exist in this milieu. We field calls daily from people who are trying to figure out whether they should call, and you know, whether they have enough information to call, whether they feel comfortable risking making the call, and you and I both understand that that's not a willing false report moving forward, but what scares me is what they'll misconstrue and as a result choose not to do. The other factor that goes into this, all of us understand kind of the concept of discrimination and assumptions that get made, and one of the things I've observed over the years is assumptions that get made in the context of custody. While it's absolutely true that false accusations can emerge during a custody battle, as you received testimony to that effect just now, it's also true that when a divorce proceeding begins, that also can create a time at which kids feel comfortable coming forward that they weren't prior comfortable because they were worried it would cause the dissolution of marriage. But once parents are separated, there's research that explains that that's also a time when a child might come forward with a legitimate abuse disclosure. And so I wanted to explain that both those factors are present, and I'm just afraid of people misunderstanding the legislation. A third area of concern would be that if folks in the judicial system hear the increase, they might presume or use in court somehow that, well, the legislature had to take action because there's been such an increase or a surge in false reports, and maybe assert that fact. But I haven't seen data to substantiate that fact, and I'm worried that that'll get played out. So I guess I just have a set of worries about how it'll end up being experienced. And so I wanted to come and share about that.
Thank you very much.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Tanya Hunt. I'm executive director of the Children's Center in Clackamas County, Oregon. At the Children's Center, we serve kids who are suspected to be victims of abuse, much like Liberty House. I want to say, as executive director of the Children's Center and also as a member of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers, it's rare for us to take a position on policy bills. This is one that we immediately were alarmed at and continue to be concerned about because of the risk of underreporting of abuse. You know, statistics show that children will report or disclose abuse 7 to 9 times before they are heard and action is taken. If you can imagine how scary that is for a child to finally muster up the confidence to make a disclosure to a teacher or a trusted adult or even a friend, and for that report not to be responded to with an investigation. Many times there is not that follow-up because somebody is second-guessing what they heard, what they saw, and they're thinking, I don't really know if this is child abuse. I don't really know what has happened, so I shouldn't make a report. That is often the case that we encounter at the Children's Center, and we are the first to urge people to call DHS or to call their local law enforcement and make that report. When it's underreported, kids are left in harmful situations, and it's a very significant risk. In Clackamas County last year, we had a child death, a young 3-year-old who was murdered in her home due to abuse. She was seen just months prior by a medical provider. That medical provider failed to make a mandatory report despite there being evidence of abuse. That is a tragic situation of an underreport. But, of course, at the Children's Center, we see hundreds of cases each year of kids who are desperate for help and are not getting that help because of underreporting of mandatory reporters and others in the community. So I ask that you carefully consider whether or not you would take any action that might discourage those reports. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice, formerly the Juvenile Rights Project. Since 1975, we have represented roughly 50,000 children and youth in the juvenile court system. Roughly 3/4 of them are children in foster care who've experienced abuse or neglect. We are also concerned, we understand there's a difference of opinion, but we are concerned about the chilling effect on mandatory reporters for fear of getting in trouble for making a mistake. This is a very complicated area. It's very confusing for mandatory reporters. I've been a mandatory reporter most of my adult life. I've worked almost exclusively with mandatory child abuse reporters during that time, and there has always been confusion about the obligation to report. My concern is that this will only add to the confusion and fear about that obligation. I wanted to provide some numbers that out of the 71,000, almost 72,000 reports made to DHS in 2010, 53,000, over 53,000 of those were made by mandatory child abuse reporters. Only 7,000, just over 7,000 reports were founded that year, which means that there were 46,000 reports made by mandatory reporters that DHS either wasn't able to determine or wasn't able to find that abuse or neglect had occurred. That's actually a sign that our mandatory child abuse reporting statute is working the way that I believe it's intended to work. It's crafted in such a way as to direct mandatory reporters, again, of which legislators, attorneys, doctors, nurses, school district employees, and various other professionals and people who work with children are, you're actually encouraged to, when in doubt, report. You're encouraged to err on the side of, if you have any kind of reasonable suspicion that abuse may have occurred, to report and turn that information over to professionals who are then able to investigate that report. My concern is that this bill works, creates an opposite force against the intent of the mandatory child abuse report. And quite simply, the chilling effect comes from the disparity between the penalty for failing to report and the penalty for knowingly making a false report. The penalty for failing to make a mandatory report is a Class A violation that carries a fine of less than $1,000 and no jail time. A Class B misdemeanor carries a potential penalty of 6 months in jail, and I believe it's $2,500 fine. And you know, we'd like to think that most of us who are child abuse reporters would make the report simply on our honest assessment of whether abuse may have occurred or not and not worry about that. But I think knowing the confusion that people already have over our mandatory report, if they know that the potential for that serious a penalty exists, and even if they feel that they may, if they were prosecuted, may prove themselves innocent or not guilty in the end, the time and the expense and the trouble of potentially facing prosecution and the legal bills that would accrue because of it would easily outweigh the potential fine for failing to make a mandatory report. So that's where that's simply where the concern about the chilling effect comes from. And we do not feel that the Dash 3 amendments remedy that problem. Looking at the Dash 2 amendments, I would say that the Dash 2 amendments do remedy that problem because it makes the penalty for failure to report and the penalty for knowingly making a false report the same. So you can, it's a wash. You can take those out of consideration, and you can, if you're a mandatory reporter, you can make the report that you honestly in your gut or in your heart feel is appropriate to make. And I will conclude my testimony there, but I'm glad to take any questions.
Any questions for this panel?
Yes. Forgive me, I have to respond. First of all, Tanya, thank you for all the great work you do. I really appreciate that. And no one up here wants to chill the effect of mandatory reporting. To be quite frank with you, I think everybody's afraid to report anything. I really believe that we are. It's just people are afraid to get involved. That's problems as community, and we're probably all guilty of it. So I just lay that out there. But I have to remind you what Representative Chair Krieger said. This is knowingly. The scenario used, which I believe that happens, is a mistake. People are afraid of making a mistake, and I appreciate that, and I don't want to slope. But knowingly make a report, a false report, that's, I really have to bring us back to that part of this conversation. Knowingly, maliciously making a false report in order to hurt the reputation of someone who's innocent. That's what I think we're trying to get at here. And in my experience on the Censored Review Committee, which the good Chair Krieger drug me into in 2005, we've seen this come up time and again, and not just in the cases we've examined, but in several other examples. And I don't think anybody in the room thinks that that's okay. I know you don't. But it's knowingly provide a false report, not mistakenly provide an inaccurate report. I really just want you to go away knowing that, and that's how I feel about it. But I really, once again, the things you do at the Children's Center, God bless you. I love supporting it. I wish you didn't exist down there, but you do, and I'm grateful you do. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, panel. Next call, Tricia Smith and Roger Williams, please.
Good Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. This is my first time testifying before your committee, so I'll take 1 second and tell you that OSEA represents 21,000 education professionals working at all levels of public education in Oregon. Our members are all mandatory reporters. I'm here to testify to our concerns about House Bill 2183 and the Dash 3 amendment. We have not seen Dash 2, so I can't speak to the Dash 2. Our members are school secretaries, custodians, bus drivers, people who are, with the exception of the small amount of training that they receive from the Department of Human Resources on the issue of reporting, know nothing about the issues of child abuse and how it's treated in the courts. Our concern is that for years we have told our members and assured that the training that they receive from the Department of Human Resources on the issue of reporting of potential abuse, the main message of that training is do not think, report. If there is any reason at all for you to think or be concerned about a situation that a child is in, report. Let the experts determine what the real situation is. We've heard and we respect the intentions of the sponsors of this bill, but the assertions that knowingly will not, that will mitigate any chilling effect of the bill, we disagree with. It implies that the person understands what that means in the law. If a school custodian sees bruises on a child and asks the child how that child got the bruises, and the child said that they got the bruises in a wrestling match, our members, if they think that might be a concern, are supposed to report. The child has said this is an innocent bruise, so they may not know that that doesn't apply the knowingly standard, that they still are going to be protected if they report. We are very concerned that our members will ever stop and think, should I report? We want them to report and let the district attorney's office, law enforcement, and the Department of Human Services determine whether abuse has occurred. We are also concerned about line 10 of the Dash 3 amendments, which makes it a larger crime to false report than to fail to report. We think that, too, will have a chilling effect if our folks know that they could have a 6-month jail time for falling into this knowingly standard. They may stop and think about whether or not they should make that phone call. And we don't want our members to stop and think about that. We want them to report. So we hope that as you take this bill forward, if that's what you choose to do, that perhaps you think about our mandatory reporters and how we can assure that their current standard, which is don't think, report, remains in effect. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Smith, so if this is to pass, how would we be able to help you be sure that training is done properly?
The Department of Human Services is required to train our folks, produce a training for our folks, which school districts must present to them each year. We would ask that you encourage the department to spend some time on the issue of false reporting and what knowingly means and how that standard would not apply in the cases that we're talking about here.
Thank you very much. That is some very sound suggestions. Mr. Williams, please.
Co-chairs, committee, my name is Roger Williams. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network. We have 65 support groups throughout the state, and we put on Apple Pie Day. So just to set things in context, the issue here that I'm hearing is we don't want a chilling effect, and to not have a chilling effect, we're willing to deny justice to those who are falsely accused. That's the issue that I'm hearing people say. I think you need to handle both. I would recommend that you have the same penalty for not reporting and false reporting. But I don't think that you should deny justice to those people who are now. There are severe penalties associated even with an accusation of child abuse, and I'm not going to go into the details on that, but you know them. I think that you need to just retrain your people. It's bad public policy to base laws on whether or not the uninformed will misunderstand the law. The correct course is to make the law clear and then educate citizens on what the law actually says. False reports of child abuse are a problem nationally, and other state governments are responding. 31 states now have some type of penalty for making a false report of child abuse and or neglect. Oregon needs to do the same. Here in Oregon, it's a Class A misdemeanor to litter, with a fine not exceeding $6,250 or imprisonment not exceeding 1 year or both. Isn't it time we take false reports of child abuse at least as seriously as we take littering? Please support HB 2183.
Thank you, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And folks, this is by no means is there any need to answer this, but I do want to emphasize that in terms of not counting them the same, the difference between failure to make a report and false report, the real I think the major difference is, and perhaps you know your members would be interested in this, is a jury trial. I mean, in order to get convicted of this proposal, a person would have to be convinced, the state would have to convince unanimously six jurors of their peers that they did this knowingly. And that's a major protection. And so, frankly, I think the protections are going up, because in a violation, it's more likely than not, it's just a judge deciding whether a person failed to make a report, more likely than not, 51%. But in terms of this proposal, it's going to be six unanimous members from the committee unanimously deciding that the person knowingly made a false report beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a much higher standard. So, indeed, I would propose, we're really, and I wish Mr. McKechnie, I wish I asked this if Mr. McKechnie is up here, because he's kind of an expert. But, so I do think there is a certain level of protection that we're adding in here, too, in terms of this elevated crime.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I appreciate the effort. Our concern is, in a person's mind, before that phone call is made, we hope that they're not evaluating whether or not they want to go through that process or risk going through that process by making the phone call. We want them to make the phone call without hesitation.
Representative, thank you. Patricia, and I agree with you, we don't want that, but I submit to you that's exactly what people do right now, and that's unfortunate. And I do not see this changing that. It's only if you knowingly submit a false report. Not if you submit a mistaken report, which is exactly what we want to avoid in the very scenario you spelled out. Are your members, our employees, we want them to report if there's suspicion of and they really are worried about it. And there's nothing in here that would hurt them in any way, harm them, or submit them to any kind of penalty or criminal prosecution underneath this bill, because they would have to knowingly submit a false report.
Mr. Chair,
I do appreciate your concerns.
I have to respond to that. The problem with that argument, Representative, is that knowingly gets decided in a trial at the end of a litigation in which the person who's doing the reporting has had to get an attorney, fight off these charges, and spend a long time and a lot of resources defending themselves. What rational person is going to want to go through that for the sake of making a report?
Mr. Chair, if I may ask the good counselor, now wouldn't a district attorney or a prosecuting attorney examine the possibility of there being a knowingly false report before they would take that to trial? Wouldn't that process go through any of my legal scholars here? I'd like to answer that question. Avoiding that incredible expense and pain to that person. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but I see some heads nodding.
Yes, they would. You'd certainly hope they would. But a rational actor faced with making a choice about making a report or not, it doesn't matter whether it's knowingly or not, because you're not going to run the risk of going to trial and being found guilty of having done something knowingly when you know you didn't. It's not worth the risk to you.
My fear, Mr. Chair, is if I see or suspect child abuse, I will not be a rational actor.
Representative Garrick raises an interesting point, which is the rational actor. One would assume that the rational actor would know the law and understand the difference between knowingly making a false report or making an honest human error in a report.
Representative Nolan.
Mr. Co-Chair, rational actors are supposed to know the law, and we all serve on this committee, and I would be willing to bet if you gave us a quiz, maybe the lawyers would pass it. But I bet the rest of the committee, and myself first in line, does not know the law well enough to know what is good or what exposes us. And so I'm nervous relying on regular citizens to know the arcane details of the law.
Mr. Chair, then we should not make them mandatory reporters in the first place.
Okay, for any further discussion, thank you, panel.
Chair, I'd like to move the dash threes into House Bill 2183.
Representative Krieger moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 2183. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
I object.
Mr. Chair, I'll ask for the sake of the record. We've heard testimony that the dash twos alleviate this concern. Is there interest in hearing the dash twos? I'm not going to make the motion. It's just going to be defeated.
That's correct, and also the dash two loops in a different section.
Okay, there would be a conflict of the amendments at this time, so what I'm going to do is close the hearing on House Bill 2183 for today. We're taking a look at this.
Mr. Co-Chair, is that carried over until tomorrow?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
And so did the amendments move into the bill or not?
They did not.
So it's in the
Okay. Opening. Hearing on House Bill 2791. Representative Thatcher, please.
For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, State Representative from House District 25. I believe this bill is a good bill for several reasons. One, it saves the state money. It helps gun owners who are now waiting for up to a month to make a purchase, and it helps small businesses trying to make it in a tough economy. First, it saves money because right now OSP spends about $7 to $8 million a biennium processing background checks for gun purchases, and about half that money comes from the fee charged to the purchaser. The other half has been a mixture of general funds and other funds in recent years. OSP now is proposing to nearly triple that fee to at least two and a half times on the gun purchasers to cover that other half of the funding they need to keep the program going. And by turning these gun background checks over to the federal government, we eliminate the need for most of these checks to be done at the state level and eliminate the need for the fee increase. Taxpayers are already paying for it. This takes the pressure off the agency to find a way to pay up to $4 million in administrative costs every biennium. Second, it helps gun purchasers. We have had multiple complaints from Oregonians, I know several other legislators have as well, regarding attempts to buy firearms from gun dealers who were told that they would take over a month to process their background checks. And often these are folks who have been buying guns for years without any problems. The FBI runs the National Instant Check System, or NICS, and they have a great track record. In fact, 92% of the background checks were completed while the gun dealer was still on the phone with the NICS. The federal system does not charge a fee to the gun purchaser. We're already paying for it in our taxes. I should add that many people view this fee, this other fee as a tax on their Second Amendment rights. Third, this bill helps small businesses in that many of the gun stores in Oregon are small mom-and-pop shops and with maybe a couple of employees. And when a customer is told they have to wait up to a month to get their background check, a lot of times they'll leave without making their purchases. The employees at the gun store sometimes have to spend hours on hold with OSP just to get through to submit the information for the background checks, and that's not good for business either. A couple other points to keep in mind is that the private party transactions, like the ones at gun shows, would still be conducted by OSP under this legislation, and they could still charge a fee for those sales. But only the federally licensed dealers would be impacted if we switch to the NICS system, which is what 35 other states currently only use. Some other states use a combination. And I have not been aware of any complaints from gun dealers or problems with criminals getting guns that they shouldn't have. This is a complete background check for criminal mental health problems, and according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which represents gun dealers across the country, they say the Oregon law does not require a more extensive background check than the already comprehensive check that is performed by the FBI. We have reviewed a comparison list of what the OSP does for their background checks and what the feds do. We haven't been able to find any significant or pertinent differences. Under the state federal law, a gun can be sold within 3 days without a background check. And if we are going to do these background checks, it would be best to do them sooner rather than later, and the feds do it sooner. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Thatcher? Thank you, Representative. I'm going to take the next people a little bit out of order. I had a request because of a time constraint. So Melanie Mole and Ralph Groner, please. And we still have several bills, so I ask you try to be brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Vice Chairs, distinguished members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME. I'm really here to introduce Melody Mole, president of my local at the State Police support staff. I will only comment that Ways and Means put a budget note on our budget saying that you will come in with fee increases to cover your budget. Two, as firearm sales were going up and licensing requires an 18% increase, my members had decreases in staff over the years because opponents to fees. I understand that. Everybody was decreasing staff. But the result is we've fallen further and further behind. My only comment when I introduce the president is I'm afraid this may look better than it seems, and there's no free lunch. I asked somebody, what will this cost the feds? And, of course, I'm told that doesn't matter. But the fact is you need to ask that of appropriate authorities. I'm told it's $11 million increase and 11 employees. The fact of the matter is if we don't increase this fee, and that's causing a big part of the problem, as well as us being behind, you're going to increase the other fees within the division because this is a part of the pie that the budget was built on by Ways and Means. So I want to say if it looks too good to be true, my papa and my grandfather told me it probably is. And at this time, I'd like to introduce our president to make some comments, Melody Mole from State Police. Thank you.
Repeat what the instruction was regarding, Ralph, the fee increase. Who gave instructions to who regarding increasing the fees? You mentioned something and I missed it.
The budget, no, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Krieger, did I do that?
Yes,
thank you, Co-Chair Krieger. The budget note, according to David Yarnell, is from this last session, and it told the state police to look at their fees in terms of funding their budget, because, as you know, general fund dollars are limited, and they were to look at fee increases. At this time, if I may, I'd like to introduce my president. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead and identify yourself, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Melody Mole, and I am the local president of AFSCME 896. I'm also an employee of the Oregon State Police Firearms Unit, so I am in two capacities here talking to you this afternoon. This was something that was just brought up this morning to me, so I just kind of did a rough draft on this. Just trying to point out there is some differences in the way that we conduct our background checks, our backgrounds compared to what the feds would do. We have a very dedicated unit. Our employees are very much aware of the call times and what's going on with our dealers, and believe me, we are very stressed out about it. We've been working a lot of overtime. It's not mandatory. It's something that the staff wants to do because they're trying to cut those times down. It's just overall, and this is a nationwide thing, firearm sales have climbed dramatically recently, and we've been hit with that increase also. Some of the things on my list here that we do a little bit differently is we process a lot of research during our transactions. There's a lot of incomplete information out there on people's criminal histories. We do the research on those, and we actually correct the Oregon criminal histories and request that those records be updated to reflect the correct information. Last year, we processed about 9,000 that we researched. Unfortunately, I don't have the facts and figures today, but in my estimate, that's probably about 50% of those are Oregon criminal histories that our department is correcting the information on. We also, we call it a BIFS flag. It's a identification federal firearm sale flag that would prohibit if it's a federal disqualifier. We set those flags on those Oregon records, which then other states can see those records and see that that person would be disqualified. Our challenge calls, we do a lot of calls throughout the day for people that have been denied. They're wanting to know the outcome of why they were denied the purchase of their firearm, or they have been delayed and they want to know why. We check that line throughout the day. We return those calls usually within a 24-hour period. Right now, I called right before I came in. The feds are out 147 days on their processing of those calls. They do nothing over the phone. Everything is in writing. So if you want to find out why you were denied, you're going to wait at least 147 days. We also do weapons checks to see if guns are lost or stolen. As a result of our regular transactions, we do that. We also will, if someone calls a private party, wants to know they're going to buy a gun from their neighbor, they want to know if it's lost or stolen. We can do that for them also. That resulted in 136 stolen guns or lost guns being recovered last year. Also, we do the private party sales, both at a gun show and not at a gun show. At this point, we are checking the Oregon Mental Health Database, which the feds do not see that database. We also check for current and valid ID. One of the things that we do also when we are doing research on a transaction, we have access to the Oregon court system called OGIN. If we're in there looking for a particular arrest segment that doesn't have a disposition, a lot of times we'll see another arrest in there that was not on their criminal history because somehow they've fallen through the cracks and they were not fingerprinted, so it didn't generate an actual criminal history on their record. That is something the feds would not see. So basically, I just wanted to say that we have an extremely dedicated, caring staff. You know, we're all citizens of Oregon. We all think this is a very important unit to have, to keep it locally. We have a lot of dealers I know that are very frustrated right now, but we also have a lot of dealers that we get compliments. They enjoy that personal communication they have with our staff. They talk to us every day. So there is a lot of people out there that do like what we do and how we do it. So basically, I'm just saying, you know, please keep us around. We think it's important. We're also citizens of Oregon, and we know how much good we do for the state.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So did you say that the feds did not see the Oregon Mental Health Database?
Correct.
Do you have any? Why not? You may not know, but
There are things in the works to get that so that, you know, it is connected, but at this point, we just have access to our Oregon mental health database.
Follow up, please.
Could you expound on that a bit? What's in the works?
There is a team or a unit that they have put together that is working to connect those records and enter those records.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you.
Kevin Sturt, Al Elkins, and Carla Ray Edwards, please. Please go ahead and in the order, identify yourself for the record.
For the record, Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee, Kevin Sturt, Oregon Firearms Federation. I was just handed a note that says that the OSP were told to review their fees, not necessarily to increase their fees. But you have written testimony from me, so you'll see that many emails that I've gotten, you obviously won't see the phone calls of people saying what a difficult time they've had communicating with the Oregon State Police if there's been a delay. In 2008, I met with the ID unit because I was getting three or four of those complaints a day. And at the time, they shared with me the handout or the manual they give to dealers to tell them what the process is. A copy of that is in with the testimony I gave you as well. In it, it specifically told dealers they were not allowed to make a transfer without a unique approval code, and that's false. They can make a transfer after 3 days as long as there hasn't been a denial. I pointed that out to them, and to their credit, I must say they have corrected that. However, what they have never changed is their policy of not informing the dealers of the truth of the law. So to this day, many dealers still believe that they can't make a lawful transfer without a state police approval. The feds, on the other hand, make that a policy to tell dealers exactly what day they in fact can make the transfer in the absence of an approval. As far as the mental health records are concerned, I'm sure you all remember the battle we had in 2009 where we turned over our mental health records to the feds, much against, you know, the wishes of the Oregon Firearms Federation, and in fact those records are already being used by the feds, and they're being used to deny people who shouldn't be denied because they had their rights restored by the court, were able to buy firearms, and now are locked out of the process and forced into this nightmare in the PSRB. In addition to that, the state police have revealed the private information of lawful transfers, and the cost to that of one of the people who had that happen to him is he lost his job, he lost his home, he lost his occupation. They approved his purchases. They then contacted local police who surrounded his house with multiple SWAT teams, took him into custody, took him to a mental hospital, entered his house without a warrant, and confiscated his property. Once he got to the mental hospital, the doctor said, there's nothing wrong with this guy, sent him home, but the police tried to keep his guns. That's how we got involved. So the problems that we have with the state police, in addition to the high cost, which is something we're paying for it anyway for the states that are getting it for no additional fee, you can see by the letter I've included from National Shooting Sports Foundation that other states that aren't point of contact states simply are not having a problem. They're not having any problems with delays and denials. And we, at one time, had an enormous improvement in service after the 2008 meeting, and now those complaints have spiked again. We have constantly hearing from people who've been buying guns for years, and now they're being told that they have to wait sometimes for months. They can delay them as long as they want. I mean, technically, they can still get the gun. Now, it was testified in the Senate version of this bill that the system is working because of all these delays, that the fact that people are being delayed constantly proves what a great job the state police are doing. But, in fact, if you look at some of the communication I've gotten, many of these people are being delayed, should never have been delayed in the first place. So our concern is that, in addition to the very high fees, which, as you've been told, the state police want to almost triple, that the information the state police is giving to dealers is not correct, and the response they've been giving to attempted purchases is not correct, and plus, you know, a tax on a firearms purchase that'll now be almost triple that, plus a potentially very long delay just seems to us to not be an appropriate way to handle something. We could very easily solve the problem. As for the stolen gun issue, I don't think there's anything in this bill that would take away the ability of the state police to do the tracking that they're doing now.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Sturt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chairs, for the record, Al Elkins
with the Oregon Hunters Association. We are one of the largest nonprofit conservation groups in Oregon. Through our association, we have 25 chapters around the state, and through their efforts of fundraisers and auctions and banquets, we put about $250,000 of our association money into wildlife and habitat projects each year. Each of our chapters raises its money through annual banquet fundraisers. As part of these fundraisers, we have auctions and raffles for guns. Currently, we estimate that the Oregon Hunters Association and its banquet guests probably spend close to $5,000 annually on background checks, and with the OSPP proposed background fee increase, that could triple to $15,000. Multiply this figure times the number of other groups holding a similar number of banquets: Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Ducks Unlimited, Northwest Wild Turkey Federation, Mule Deer Foundation, and NRA. You have a large sum of money increase from this fee. We believe this to be a waste of conservation dollars. In summary, we'd just like to say, we believe in background checks. We just like to see them done at no cost. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Elkins? Ms. Edwards, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. My name is Carla K. Edwards. I'm actually with Cascade Policy Institute, but I'm before you here today as a firearms retail license holder. My husband and I have a small mom-and-pop shop that we've spent a number of years getting started, and we are one of the registered licensed firearm dealers that spends a lot of charitable time actually registering for fundraising events like NRA and Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, so we are very aware of the background check issue. We believe this is a good governance system. We believe that this is just a simple removal of a layer that may be unnecessary. 35 states obviously currently do go to a direct dealer, and I will remind you, as we fill out paperwork, the 4473 is in fact a federal paperwork system that we fill out today. So it isn't a duplicate, it's a duplication of systems, but we actually are already dealing with the federal firearms issue. This system would allow us to provide the information electronically. And why we're here today is really our competitive edge for a firearms retailer. It's very competitive on the internet. What we bring and offer as a small local retailer is customer service. To be able to answer and address questions that our customers have and their concerns and fitting them, we specialize in dealing with women. Luckily, because I've had bad experiences at other firearms, that gave me the passion to want to start that. What happens is often, and you can count on it during paycheck day, the 1st, 5th, 20th, and 15th of the month, we spend a lot of time on hold, unfortunately. That is also the time that our store is incredibly busy. And my husband is often there alone because I sit here a lot. So it is very difficult for us to take advantage of why people come and see us when we're on hold trying to get a background check for a client and waiting for having other customers wait for us to be able to talk to them and show them the gun and fit them correctly to what their needs are. So the ability to expedite the system either electronically, so we're not sitting on the phone lines, or being able to get a quicker response is really important to us, as well as the fact that the fee that is charged is actually paid directly by the customer. We charge them. And when it becomes exorbitant, it becomes a factor of whether they are ready to buy that gun today, if they have to wait and know that that fee is forward to them. So just recognize that we're trying to make a profit and survive in this very competitive retail end, and it actually, that wait delays our only competitive advantage, which is customer service.
Thank you. Is there any questions in this panel? Thank you, panel, very much. Let's call on Brian Stone and Rod Harder.
Members of the chair and representatives, my name is Brian Stone. I'm a small business owner here in Oregon. I've had a gun retail store for 17 years. I didn't know a whole lot about this bill until this weekend. I did a little research online, and so I just made it a point this morning. I called some stores all over the nation this morning. I called Virginia and talked to them about their background system, which they have a state-ran background check system. Their fee, I believe, is $3. But with their budget constraints and everything, they've been cut back. Their hold times are a lot longer. And he referenced to within the last month that they were at a firearm show in Virginia and were delayed. 80 of their guns were delayed. So, and he was a small-time business owner. And you can imagine 80 guns that were delayed. That's 80 transactions did not go through. So, I mean, he basically had to cancel those transactions. Then I called Idaho this morning, who is right across our border. They use the National Instant Background Check system. He could only think of two hiccups in their whole system the whole time, and that was when the system was down for a couple, 3 hours. That was the only time they were delayed, and they're not paying any fees because it's already through the National Background Check. It's free. We're paying the taxes on that through our federal government to have that the system for free. So, you know, every time I have to make a phone call and I have two employees in my store, myself and one other employee, and I'm on hold for 45 minutes to sometimes at a gun show for an hour and a half, and I have people walking away from my tables or leaving my store because they can't get a background check, I'm losing business. I mean, I'm a firm believer in background checks. I've been in the industry for 35 years. I've seen a lot of different background systems go through in the last 35 years. I mean, this one works. And I think the Fed's system will work just as well as our system in the state. I mean, the state, I have a good rapport with the state here. The call takers are all polite, everything. They get our answers. But they're overburdened, and I don't think we should have to be double paying for something that we're already paying for through the Feds. Why should we pay through the state? I guess that's what I'm here to say today.
Thank you very much. Mr.
Harder. Chair Barker, Chair Krueger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder with the National Rifle Association, here today in support of House Bill 2791. Over the past several weeks, I have researched the entire country through my contact in headquarters of NRA, and I think the story that we're hearing about the federal system is pretty much on the mark. I've not heard anything from any of the people that have the federal system saying that it's bad. Wisconsin, for instance, has recently gone under the federal system as a budget-saving measure. During the Senate hearings, we've heard some information. I'm very disappointed at the state police on here today because there's some questions I think that need to be answered about this, and it would be helpful if we got those. One of those was that the feds don't do mental records. Well, that's absolutely false. Feds do mental records, and many of you remember the big mess that we had with House Bill 2853 2 years ago. They are required by that bill, Oregon is required to furnish mental records to the feds. If they've done it or not, I'm having difficulty determining that. And hopefully, or I wish that they had been here so that they could answer that question. If they are sending them as they're required to do, and I believe they have been funded by the feds with a grant to do that, I'd be interested in knowing how many have been sent and what the schedule is for sending the balance. NRA, like Oregon Hunters Association, has banquets across this state, and we spend thousands of dollars on background checks. And over the last 4 years, we've put almost $1 million back on the ground in Oregon. Tripling those fees, or very close to tripling those fees, are going to take money away from money that could be coming back here. I think all in all, we are, as has been alluded to, the feds are now being paid to run that system. I question whether it's going to cost them an additional $11 million to add Oregon to it. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions and would ask. I've already given some members questions that the state police would be helpful if they answered. And if we could get those questions answered as we go forward, I think that would be a real benefit.
Thank you. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sympathetic to this concept, and I think there's made a compelling argument that's been made why we shouldn't be paying more than when we can get it from the federal government now. But, Rod, this is not just at you. This is a blanket statement. Using Wisconsin as an example is not compelling testimony for me. I just wanted to share that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? And I'll just say that I've heard complaints about stores being stalled and customers leaving because they can't get a check. And and other people are waiting to come in and store it. While you're checking the one person, they'll leave. Another thing that came up earlier last year, I was contacted by the pawn shop industry, and they pawn frequently, guns are pawned through their system. They take the gun in, do the $10 check, run it through all the to see if it's stolen or lost. They do all those checking, and then people have to get check it back out. They said if this goes to $30, nobody will be able to afford to pawn a gun, and that way the guns, I don't know what happens then. Are they just sold on the street or what? Right, they're not going to go through a background check if somebody needs some quick money. And the pawn industry was very concerned about the increase in price up to $28 for the checks. They said that would just really take them out of that business. And I think it's helpful when guns go through the system where they are checked, so we have a better idea of not only the gun itself, but the person that's transacting with the gun. So, any further questions? Thank you very much. Representative Wisnan.
Thank you. What are the chair's plans? I'd like to make a statement.
Okay, please make it.
I think that our general government committee has been looking at this issue, and it's not just citizens are here talking about this, but it's within the state system. We're spending over $200 million at least because the body has put all these requirements for background checks on people. So we're planning to have some meetings within the general government, the Consumer Protection Committee, to look at what we've done and what we're requiring. And remember, we talked also about the fact how sometimes we're paying and getting something, it doesn't help us because of the OLCC gentleman and Ben, who we didn't know he wasn't who he said he was, and because he didn't have the right check. So it's a big project, a lot of money being spent for background checks based upon laws that we've passed on our own people. It's sort of different or not directly related to the people who have been testifying today. But it is expense. It is a big expense to the state, and we are planning to look at that during the interim.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the bill is not ready to be worked today, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2791. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3615. Okay. Representative Gerard, please. Thank you for waiting.
Mr. Chair,
a great oyster story on Channel 10 last night. Please go ahead. We have several people wanting to speak on this bill today, so.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm Bill Gerard, representative of District 56, Southern Klamath County. There are others much more knowledgeable to follow my testimony, but I'll try to give you a brief overview as to why we are here today to present to you HB 3615. It will also have a -1 amendment, which my understanding is the committee has not had an opportunity to see yet. But we will ask you to put the -1s into the bill. Before you today is 3615. The embryo of this bill was developed 2 years ago in the Big Look Task Force. Its concept is simple. Under the auspices of LCDC, elected officials of three Oregon counties pursue a regional definition of agricultural land and farmland. House Bill 3615 creates a three-county pilot project that will explore allowing the commissioners of three counties, Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas, to explore regional definitions of farm and forest lands. These three counties were chosen because they are contiguous and share many similarities in their topography. They also possess excellent planning departments and commissioners who have wide and experience in land use. In an April 5th letter to the President of the Senate and the two House co-chairs, Governor Kitzhaber wrote the following in the second paragraph of his letter. I firmly believe that our land use system contributes to the economic health of our state. One of the strengths of the land use program is that it requires local governments to provide a long-term supply of developable land, both for housing and development. In the Portland metro area, in response to studies in the late 90s that showed a shortage of land for employment, over 10,000 acres have been added to their for their uses, and the urban reserves effort nearing completion will assure that supply is maintained over time. Similar efforts have been approved or are well underway in Bend, Redmond, Pendleton, LeGrand, Ontario, Woodburn, Springfield, Grants Pass, and in the Rogue Valley. That's what House Bill 3615 is all about. It's the right bill at the right time.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Hicks. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Representative Wally Hicks, House District 3, representing most of Josephine County. One question that may be lingering in certain minds is why these three counties? And I would submit that one of the answers to that is actually in the record that's been submitted by Attorney Jack Swift, and what I'm going to do is point out paragraph 3 of his document, which is an account of actual evidence. This isn't this is kind of a rare thing, but we have actual evidence here of what happened when the land designations were originally made under the existing law. And so this is what he explains. An additional historic fact this committee should be aware of is the erroneous designation of vast stretches of land in the Josephine County Comprehensive Plan as high-value farm and forest land. In the course of litigation of a federal case, Citizens for Constitutional Fairness versus Jackson County, 08-3025-PA, in the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon, I, Jack Swift, received the sworn affidavits from two gentlemen, each of whom was employed in either the Planning Department for Josephine or Jackson County at the time of the creation of the county's land development comprehensive plans. These affidavits were introduced in the action as evidence and were subject to challenge by both Jackson County and the state. They stand uncontroverted and may be viewed using the PACER access system to the federal courts. In the citizens' case, they are documents number 59, declaration of Bob Hart, and document number 74, sworn statement of Chris Weaver. The import of these affidavits is that when comprehensive statewide land use regulation was imposed, both Josephine and Jackson County undertook to establish the contemplated land inventories according to the published directives. Soil analyses were undertaken, aerial evaluations were undertaken, and the targeted high-value lands were identified. A plan was developed based on those best efforts. Upon review of those plans by the Department of Land Conservation and Development, however, it was determined that the county's inventories were inadequate. Each county needed more high-value farm and forest lands to protect. Thereupon, each county was compelled to redraw its map to meet quotas established by the DLCD, which isn't the way it was supposed to go. This is what happened. This is what the official at the time were telling us, and that was not the way it was supposed to go. I have an ad-lib there, but the result is that a great percentage of the so-called high-value farm and forest land in Josephine and Jackson County is erroneously, and then Jack Swift adds, perhaps even fraudulently, designated as things stand today. So the problem was when the original law was passed, it was erroneously implemented. So this is an appropriate pilot program for this particular region of our state to correct something that was done wrong the first time. Thank you, members.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions from the panel?
Mr. Chair, just say a good bill should pass, and it's about time you guys control your neighborhood rather than people up in some concrete jungle telling you how to run your neighborhood. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Kelly Manning, Keith Kubik, and Carla Edwards. And we do ask you to be as brief as you can. We had a lot of people testify today, but we want to hear all your testimonies. Please go ahead.
Certainly. Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members. My name is Kelly Matting. I'm the Development Services Director for Jackson County, and I'm here on behalf of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners to express their support for House Bill 3615-1. Jackson County supported the efforts of the Big Look Task Force. The county wholeheartedly agreed with the primary conclusion reached by that task force, which was that Oregon needs a more flexible land use system, one that responds to regional variations rather than providing a one-size-fits-all standards. House Bill 3615-1 takes an important step in that direction by allowing Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas counties the opportunity to work collaboratively as a region and amend the state's definition of agriculture and forest lands. As you all know, this three-county region is geographically unique. While we do possess farm and forest lands that should continue to remain under the state's Goal 3 and 4 protections, we also have a significant land base where neither agriculture nor forestry are economically viable uses. This land is inappropriately regulated through the state's one-size-fits-all definitions. Without the allowance for this project, for a project such as this, these lands will continue to be inappropriately zoned and underutilized. Jackson County has no desire to remove protections that preserve the prosperity of the commercial, agricultural, and forestry sectors of our regional economy. Agriculture and forestry are vital not only to our region's economic success, but to our quality of life. Rather, the Jackson County Commissioners believe this legislation will allow our region to tailor the one-size-fits-all state definition of farm and forest land to better fit our unique environment. The Jackson County Commissioners support House Bill 3615-1, and while we believe that there are still language changes that need to occur, we are confident that those issues can be worked out as this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Keith Kubik. I'm Planning Director for Douglas County, representing our county and our county commissioners today. Simply, I passed out a written statement to you. We believe that the legislation that was adopted in House Bill 2229 provided an opportunity to look at mapping and farm and forest lands, but didn't provide an opportunity to look at the definitions that are in the statewide planning program. This bill does that. This bill achieves what I think the purpose should have been and maybe was of House Bill 2229. Overall, Douglas County supports the concept of a regional analysis and definition of farm and forest lands in Oregon. The framework set out in House Bill 3615 sub 1 or dash 1 is acceptable. I would note that my county commissioners had concerns about the language of 3615 as the original draft bill, and we ask you to encourage and entertain forwarding the sub 1 or dash 1 a draft. The county, Douglas County, believes the bill sets acceptable standards for starting the process. It outlines an acceptable procedure for dealing with other lands that might spin out of the designation, a regional designation of farm and forest lands. And it sets out an acceptable process for LCDC review of any appeals that might come out of this. The bill's text on non-resource lands may need some tweaking a little bit, but I think we believe that could be resolved in completion of this bill before it's presented to the governor's office. The bill in dash one also sets out realistic funding opportunities for the county and a role for LCDC in that funding authorization. There is one issue in section 5 of the dash 1 amendment that I'd like to ask you to pay particular attention to, and that's clarification that the intergovernmental agreement between the three southwestern Oregon counties is not a land use decision. Very simple. It just needs to say that's not a land use decision, so it's not subject to the land use appeals process. It's an intergovernmental agreement between the three counties. The bill also authorizes in the future up to two additional pilot programs. We anticipate that the pilot program that would be established from southwestern Oregon would be carefully monitored by the Department of Land Conservation and Development, that the results of that would be proposed to them. It would help set a model for which statewide planning rules could come as a result of that initial pilot project study. So we think it's a good process, and we think it is appropriate for potentially some other pilots following our completion of the project. Douglas County recommends favorable action on House Bill 3615-1, recognizing the need for two minor clarifications. We believe this is a very important concept to Oregon. It's an appropriate refinement of Oregon's statewide planning program after almost 40 years. One issue that I would speak to that were raised potentially in Jackson and Josephine County are what some would characterize as inappropriate zoning in the initial planning of their jurisdictions. That issue does not exist in Douglas County. So this would be just a straightforward look at our designations of farm and forest lands and a potential redefinition that would result from that would be compatible with the other two counties in southwestern Oregon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Carla K. Edwards. I'm with Cascade Policy Institute, and I'm the rural policy analyst for Cascade Policy Institute. The number one complaint as I travel this state is the lack of local control of land use decisions. It is difficult for us to sit here and look you in the eye and say we agree to increasing bureaucracy, which is essentially adding a regional level. But we believe that this is really an important step of moving the decisions back to a more local basis so that they can truly define what is important regionally. And that is the most important thing for the citizens of Oregon, is that they have an ability to reach out and define truly what are the natural resources and agriculture in their definition, in their region to define. And therefore, we believe that this is a good bill, offers an opportunity to create a pilot project to let folks know that regional folks are able to actually define what is happening in their own communities. We don't need the state to tell them. So therefore, we support the bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you. John Brosi, Dave Honeycutt, and Sean Gillians. And again, we are pushing up against the clock. I appreciate the summary is just here.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, member of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 3615, and particularly with the Dash Ones. We hope that the committee will entertain the Dash Ones, move that into the bill, and then send the bill to Ways and Means with a favorable recommendation. This is an important bill. It gives some direction. Really, the best way to describe the bill is it gives direction to LCDC to allow the counties, the three counties identified in the bill, to come up with a petition to present to LCDC to adopt a regional definition of farm and forest land for those counties. The bill doesn't do anything that LCDC doesn't already have the authority to do. The commission already has the authority to adopt regional definitions. These aren't statutory definitions. You won't find a statute that defines ag land or forest land. Those are done by goals. LCDC has this authority, but what this bill does is it adds a little policy direction from the policy-making body of this state. You give a little policy direction to the commission to consider when the three counties identified are approaching the commission and asking for a different definition of farm and forest land for those three counties. Very important bill. I know the department has some concerns with the bill as written, but pay attention to their letter, because I believe that that as this bill works its way through the building, we're obviously going to have some additional meetings. It's been hard to coordinate a meeting with county commissioners from three counties, county planning directors from three counties, two state representatives, and everybody that's interested in the bill. So we've been having a hard time getting everybody in the room, but I know you're up against a deadline. So if you could forward this with a favorable recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee, and from there, I know that we're working hard on getting an additional, however many additional meetings we need to get together, so that we can all come back to that committee with a thumbs up, yes, we've reached something that the governor's office, the department, and everybody can support.
Okay. Thank you.
My name is John Brosi. I'm a planning consultant. My office is in Salem, Oregon. I've been in this business since 1973, coincidentally also the year of Senate Bill 100. I've been a consultant since 79, owned my own business for 22 years. I've been up and down this state. I've had projects from the North Portland Harbor to Malin, Oregon, from Seaside to Vail, from Phoenix, Oregon to the Dalles. It's a big, diverse state. I've been all over it. I'm invested in the system, obviously, as a lifelong resident as well as a planning practitioner. There's always going to be a certain amount of controversy in this business, this nature of the beast. But what gives me a lot of pain as a citizen who loves the state is the unnecessary controversy, where you have this comes from a one-size-fits-all form and forest definitions in a very big, diverse state. and also the poor resource land mapping that occurred during the rush to acknowledgement in the counties in the mid-1980s. And we're living with those bad, unfortunate mapping decisions today, creating a lot of unnecessary animosities. I think that you're going to get a big bang for your buck this time around, and it with this, particularly with this pilot project, because of the incredible improvement in the GIS databases and technologies for mapping from the mid-1980s to now. You'll get a much better value for your dollar. I heartily support HB 3615, including the Dash 1 amendment, and recommend that you pass this on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jillians, please.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, in support of 3615 and the Dash 1 amendments. I think my colleagues have done a great job of outlining the issues there. We are very supportive, and I would just echo Mr. Honeycutt's comments that this has come a long way very quickly. We've had a number of discussions with the governor's natural resources advisor, the department, and I think we're headed in the right direction. I think the Dash 1s are very positive step for our state. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll cut it off because I know you have a very full agenda.
Thank you very much. Any questions in this panel? Representative Wisniewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am against the bill. It's not Deschutes County. County commissioners support the bill. I just wish it was Deschutes County. I wanted to make for the record Deschutes County commissioners asked to support the bill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Steve Malloy, Jerry Litz, and Peggy Lynch, please. And as you probably heard me say, we have several more bills we're going to try to get through before 3 o'clock, so we appreciate if you could summarize, but we want you to have your full explanations, please.
Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger, my name is Jerry Lids. I am the acting director at the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I think the previous witness said this bill has come a long way in a short time. Mr. Honeycutt commented that he anticipated ongoing discussions with our department and others, and we think that's the most important thing to keep in mind here. But I want to clarify a couple of the department's concerns and clarify what we think really is at issue here. Two or three of the witnesses mentioned mapping errors, and we agree that those mapping errors did result in the 1980s. And last session's, or 2009's, House Bill 2229 was designed to create a process to remedy those errors. This is a different issue today. This has to do with redefining what farm and forest lands are under the statewide goals. We are prepared to, we've heard the issue of one size fits all doesn't work. We are prepared to work with the three counties to develop regional definitions. The concerns I have about the bill are that the process is not exactly clear yet, and I think it is very important that when we embark on this enterprise, everybody understand who goes first, which things we do together, when something comes to the commission, who's working on it at which stages. And at least to me, that's not yet clear. I think we can reach agreement on those things, but I don't know for sure. We haven't had those conversations in detail. My written testimony outlines some of the concerns we have. I don't think I need to repeat that. I do want to agree with one comment Mr. Honeycutt made, which is that the commission, LCDC, does already have this authority. So what we're not looking for you to give direction, but we welcome it if you do.
Thank you
for the opportunity.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I want to highlight what Director Lid said about HB 2229, that there is a way to remap out there already, if that's necessary. I also want to talk about one-size-fits-all nature of Oregon's land use law. I gave to you each a list of, let's see here, I think there are 16 differences by area of the state and 8 by jurisdiction. This was in 2006. Since then, there are other differences, and including the HB 2229 remapping is allowed by region, or actually it's by county. So there already are many differences throughout the state, including actually in the definition of agricultural land. There are two different definitions of agricultural land for Eastern Oregon and Western Oregon to reflect the differences between soil productivity and the agricultural practices in those two parts of the state. This bill, we feel, like trades long-term jobs in agriculture and in forestry for short-term construction jobs, primarily in residential. Ag is one of every 8 jobs in the state, 15% of the product, and forest products are also a large part of the state. We're currently in a residential real estate bust, and we are not going to build our way out of it with more residential. The factors, some of them are about things like speculation of the future of agriculture in the region, basically, again, short-term construction jobs. It does not take into account conflicts with agriculture, which is another concern that we have. And again, it would add more complexity in the state. So we oppose the introduced and -1 amendments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peggy Lynch. I'm with the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We're a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League supports our statewide land use planning program with local implementation, and I emphasize with local implementation. We have 242 cities in this state, 240 of them at least, have acknowledged comprehensive plans in development codes. The two newest cities, I think, are still completing their work in 36 counties that have the same. But I want to focus on a couple of other things, and I have concerns about the bill. I just saw the -1s as I came in the room today, but the first thing I thought of when I saw the bill was what would the fiscal be. So the other thing I do besides follow policy issues here at the legislature is I follow the budget. And as I understand it, this would be a $350,000 grant need for local governments. And I have been told the possibility of that maybe DLCD would need at least $50,000 to do the work going forward. For those of you who don't know, the natural resource agencies this session got together before the session and developed their budget in conjunction with the governor's office. So it's unclear to me where the $350,000 to $400,000 would come from, because if it comes from the natural resource agency's pie, DLCD has already taken a 12% reduction from current services level. So I am very concerned. Are we, is this in turn for teachers, for OYA beds, for OPI? $400,000 is a lot of money. DLCD has in its plan to begin this process, so it's not as if they are not beginning this process. The other thing I guess the League would like to say is that we have a real concern that if you move this bill to Ways and Means, that you will be doing policy work in Ways and Means. And it has always been our feeling that policy work needs to go to policy committees. And we feel really strongly about that. We are very anxious to work on this bill should it go forward. We believe very strongly in the land use planning system. We followed the Big Look Task Force. We have followed the Bear Creek work that's been done down in Jackson County. We do believe that we can do better in Oregon with our land use planning system. but we are concerned right now about this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you, panel. Representative Esquivel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. Just to follow up a little bit here, what this is actually about, I'm going to give you a little bit of history in Jackson County.
And Representative, I'd appreciate if you could condense it because we have some more bills to go. So if you could.
You want me to talk like an auctioneer?
Not quite.
Like, you want me to get Obie down here?
If you could, please.
Okay. This stemmed from 1970s when we tried to conform with Senate Bill 100. A lot of properties in Jackson County were inappropriately zoned, and this will be a vehicle for this to be undone instead of going through a bunch of hoops. There is a fiscal on it, so therefore it has to go to Ways and Means. I don't know how it jumped up to 400, but it's 250,000, I believe, in the bill. But anyway, this, and I can show you land in Jackson County that is completely worthless, that you cannot grow anything on except black widows and spiders, and yet it's EFU. So this will correct some of those wrongs that were done with just looking at a map and drawing lines.
Thank you. I really appreciate your indulgence.
No sweat. I can take the hint. I can take the hint, Chair Barker.
I can grow blackberries on that one. That's why I'm not
much. Not there.
It was not an auctioneer.
Should we move this way? Okay, the bill is not ready to go out today because we just received the Dash Run amendment, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3615. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3259.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe 3259 is one of Mr. Johnston's bills, in which case we would request the chairs to carry it over to a day when Mr. Johnston is here.
Carry House Bill 3259 over till tomorrow. Work session, House Bill, I'm sorry, House Joint Resolution, HGR 34.
Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 34 comes to you from Representative Barker and Krieger. It refers to the voters' amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow legislative assembly to prohibit the furnishing of sexually explicit materials to minors so long as a prohibition is consistent with the United States Constitution. As the chair, members of the committee, it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee, excuse me, Rules Committee, because it's an amendment to the Constitution. Fiscals in the term.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we move HGR 34 to the Rules Committee.
Representative Krieger moves HGR 34 to the Rules Committee. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair, I would say that it's unfortunate we couldn't solve the settlement right here. It's not very important.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
I'll be happy to vote yes for this since it's the last time I'll be able to vote yes for it.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Muller.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tillman.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. HGR 34 is set to rules.
Well, that's funny.
Next on the agenda, House Bill 21, open at work session, House Bill 2142. Council, would you read us the dash vice, please?
2142?
Just a moment.
Committee, stand at ease for a few minutes. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2648.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a work session. The bill has previously been heard. We're opening.
I'm sorry. Thank you. A work session.
House Bill 2648 was previously heard on February the 10th. A brief record was made by me on the 13th, and then we heard from witnesses as to the amendments only on the 15th. The amendment at issue today to the committee is the dash one, which Representative Gelzer previously testified to. It replaces the original content of the measure, allowing persons who use physical force in supervising incompetent persons to be criminally charged. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact and no subsequent referral.
Is there any questions, any discussion?
We need to put the dash ones in.
That's correct. Okay. Mr. Chair, the amendments haven't been moved into
Mr.
the
Chair,
bill.
I'd like to move the dash ones into House Bill 2648.
Representative Krieger moves the dash ones into House Bill 2648. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2648 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2648 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative.
Thank you. I'm just trying to catch up here. Can we just briefly get another description of this?
This is the bill Representative Gelzer testified about that deals with, when the law was originally written, people who were disabled, usually mentally disabled, they were allowed to be treated like children at that time where they would be slapped or strapped or whatever. And it prohibits that in today's trying to modernize the law so that people that are with disabilities aren't abused.
Okay, so if I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. So the dash one amendment takes out minor or incompetent person. Now we're just talking a minor. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's correct, Representative Tomei.
Thank you.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson. Aye. Representative Shoffer.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Wilman.
Aye.
Representative
Chair. Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries, and we'll ask Representative Gelzer to carry that on the floor. Okay. We'll carry over House Bill 3295. And okay. Okay. Open the work session on. Open the work session, House Bill 2694. Mr. Powell, please.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, to remind you, we discussed this briefly yesterday. House Bill 2694 pertains to details in sheriffs executing warrants particularly nuisance warrants and writs of eviction. There was a question that arose yesterday about the effect this would have on the distribution of costs to plaintiffs who are making report of a nuisance, and concerns raised by some representatives that this might be causing costs to shift to that that individual. So Mr. Powell is here to address that point.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is John C. Powell on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association here in support of House Bill 2694. And I apologize for, we have caused a lot of confusion on this issue, and hopefully we can clarify that today. This is a very narrowly tailored bill that affects an issue that rarely happens. With me is Deputy Sheriff Marshall Ross, who works in this area, who can explain it further. But I just, before I hand off the testimony to him, want to stress that this has no effect on public nuisances or any violations of city or county nuisance codes. So if you have garbage piled up in your yard and it's a violation of a city nuisance, and the sheriff is called out to abate that nuisance, you don't pay for that. This only affects a private versus private lawsuit in a rare case where the sheriff has to go abate the nuisance, and the deputy will explain how that works now and how that would work under this bill.
Okay, thank you, Deputy. Go ahead, please, go ahead.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'm Marshall Ross. I'm a senior deputy with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. I work in the civil unit here on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. This is a warrant that is issued after a lawsuit where a neighbor sues a neighbor for what the law terms a private nuisance. It's not a nuisance that's phoned in to a sheriff, or that's an ordinance violation, or even in a separate body of law, what we have is a public nuisance. This is something that doesn't arise to any violation of society's laws. In 23 years of working in the sheriff's civil unit, I have seen one of these cases, and it was a case of a very upscale neighborhood where one neighbor was torqued at another neighbor because he had a dead car, two dead jet skis, and a semi-aggressive dog, none of it which is a violation of any public ordinance or anything that would get a public agency involved. This neighbor was a person with means, got his attorney to sue his other neighbor, and got a warrant for the sheriff to go in there and abate the nuisance. This is a unique body of law. Unlike all other civil actions, in all other civil actions, before a sheriff takes action on behalf of a plaintiff, the plaintiff gives the sheriff the money to remedy the situation, collect their judgment, or do whatever to ensure that the sheriff doesn't get stuck with the bill. This private nuisance lawsuit statute has the sheriff go and abate the nuisance, and at the sheriff's expense, and then has the sheriff morph into a collection agency and go after the defendant for the cost that the sheriff's incurred. This bill shifts that to mirror every other lawsuit that we have in Oregon, and it then gives the plaintiff all the remedies of a judgment creditor, as in every other lawsuit in Oregon, where the plaintiff then has all the rights of a judgment creditor to collect what they have had to pay to abate this private nuisance.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate that clarification, Mr. Powell and Mr. Ross. Thank you, Ross.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, allow me to put on the record again that this is projected to have no fiscal or revenue impact. And this is the intro version of the bill, no amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2694 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Hicks moves House Bill 2694 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative North.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Right.
Representative Shopler.
Aye.
Representative Joanne.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Business.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Motion who would like to carry that? Representative Hicks will be the carrier. I need to announce that we are carrying over for the work session on House Bill 2791, 3615, and a reminder that tomorrow night we have a meeting.
Well, I'm seeing you then. Have you given me a memo?
5:30.
5:30 to
5:15. 5:15 in the tomorrow.
Adjourned.